The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
Right there. That is Mr. Steve Hunter. Awesome on the edge of uncertainty. And of course, that's off his latest album, Before the Lights Go Out. And you guys, you know who this person is. You know, he's an amazing guitar legend. You know, and from his 1973 solos with Alice Cooper's Billion Dollar Babies album, his legendary acoustic work on Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill, his intro to Lou Reed's Sweet Jane, and his searing opening solos on Aerosmith's version of Train Keep a Rolling, and even more, you know, including even making the appearances on Alice Cooper's 2017 album Paranormal, you know, which makes his ninth appearance on a Cooper album. He is still the Deacon of Rock and Roll, and he just proved it to you right there. You know, that right there is some sexy riffs. And what's even sexier about that whole idea is that we happen to have Mr. Steve Hunter on the phone with us right now. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great, Diana. How are you?
I am fantastic. That is one sexy piece of music right there, brother.
Good. That's what we like to hear. Yeah.
I'm telling you, man, I've got my cans on, and I was sitting here listening to this, you know, before I was going to bring you in live, and I'm just like, this rocks, man, this is fantastic. I'm on another planet right now.
Good.
It's
good. That's good.
It's good. How's everything treating you in Arizona right now?
Well, it's actually pretty good. It's a little chaotic. I mean, I think as we told you, we're planning on moving to Spain. So
yes,
there's a lot of craziness going on here, getting ready to do that. And I'm going to have some cataract surgery next week, so that's going to throw another thing into it. So it's a little crazy, a little chaotic, but it's all good.
It's fantastic. And I knew, and you did tell me that you were making this big move, which is a fantastic thing. And then before we go any further, I want to give a huge shout out to your wife, Karen. She is one amazing lady.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. I was just going to kind of throw that in there, man. I figured, you know, you might want to keep her, you know.
Yep.
She's been so fantastic in making sure that you and I have stayed connected and making sure that you and I both stay on point with our schedules. And you know, yep. And without her, I think you and I would be in four different directions. So,
oh, listen, that happens all the time. I mean, that's what she does for me, is keep everything all sorted out for me.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, it's funny because, you know, Steve, and for those of you that have tuned in, you're tuned into Radio Memphis Around the World, and I am hanging out with the most awesome, legendary Steve Hunter. And the funny thing is that, you know, anybody who plays guitar, anybody who knows who you are, and we're talking about even some of the guitar greats that everybody follows. I mean, they love what you do. They follow what you do. The beautiful thing for me is that this particular album that you've just dropped, Before the Lights Go Out, one is very, it's very symbolic for you, okay?
Yep.
Two, you know, it's you. I just played a song and it was like, that right there is Yoda. Yoda just told you what rock sounds like. And you know, and this there's this tone, there's this sound, and there's this thing that you latch on to. Now, do you want to kind of tell everybody what the purpose was for you coming out with this particular album?
Yeah, the last album I did, which was called Manhattan Blues Project, was more of a concept album. It was gentler. I was trying to draw pictures, if it will. I mean, I know that sounds probably a little arty,
no,
corny.
Not at all.
Drawing pictures of some of my favorite places in New York City.
I got you.
In the 70s, I did a lot of traveling to Manhattan to do recording with Alice and Lou and even some stuff with Peter Gabriel we did in New York.
Right.
And so, I mean, I really love the city, and I always love going back there. And I just wanted to draw some pictures of all of my favorite places in New York City.
Right.
But in this next album, I wanted to do more. It's almost like I kind of went back to rediscovered my rock roots.
Mm.
There's a certain way that rock and roll music was played back in the 70s.
Yep.
that's in my fingers, you know, I can't really get rid of it. And well, I don't want to.
Don't do that. What do you No.
No, I want it to stay there too. I like it. I mean, I like the way my fingers feel playing it. So
sure.
I thought maybe on this album, I thought maybe I would experiment and do some things that if I were to put it in my mind playing in the 70s, how has it evolved? I wanted to bring back some of the stuff that I really liked playing.
Sure.
And I it's funny because it was enormous amount of fun. What I do when I do an album, I might set a little goal like that, and then if it doesn't work out, it's okay. I just move on to something else.
Well, sure.
So I'm always prepared for it to, you know, fall on its face, and then it's not going to work. I'll try something else. But as it turned out, this turned out to be a lot of fun. And what happens is once you get past the hump of the first song, then it's like this. It's almost like the dam bursts, and you have to figure out when to stop. It just keeps coming, and that's a wonderful feeling. You know,
it
I mean,
is.
It's always really difficult to start an album, but boy, once you get it started, it's difficult to stop.
It's wonderful. You know, Steve, what's really funny, and one of the things I also appreciate about you, and of course, you know, you kind of figured this out. And I say this every time, and those that tune in all the time, they know what I'm getting ready to say. I stalk, I dig. You know, I try to find out some information and stuff like that. And what I was trying to look for was something that was real conducive to Before the Lights Go Out and for the sound, and kind of what it meant to me, you know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, you really, you know, not only did you reach back into, you know, what's considered your roots, and this is me, you know, coming, you know, talking to you from Memphis, okay? And there was this real blues factor, you know, that came,
oh, absolutely.
That really came into...
Absolutely. I mean, blues is where I started.
See?
When I decided to become a musician, one of the things that helped me make that decision was when I started hearing, well, like Cream, like bands like Cream,
right,
and Jimmy Page, of course, and Jeff Beck, and John Mayall, and Paul Butterfield. All these guys were Michael Bloomfield. They were all playing blues, and I just immediately was attracted to it, but I didn't really understand why. I mean, your first instinct about blues, or your first impression, is that it's really simple.
It's not.
You know, it's three chords, and you just kind of jam over them. Well, yeah, okay, but when you really get into it, it's one of the more complex types of music out there, and it's for subtle reasons. It's like I couldn't figure out why. When I played along with B.B. King records,
I couldn't figure out
why I didn't sound like him.
I'm glad you brought him up, because one of the things I turned up, you know, and of course B.B. King being near and dear to our hearts here in Memphis, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Of course. You know, there was a cool thing. GuitarPlayer.com actually did a story on you a while, and it's been several years. But you told the story that, and it was actually fall of 1970, that you and some bandmates, you know, you guys had actually drove the 4 hours to Chicago because you had to go see B.B. King.
Yes.
And it was at a really cool dinner club. Actually, the dinner club is called Mr. Kelly's. And you couldn't you couldn't afford the dinner. You could, you know, barely the show. And you had to sit at the bar. It was really cool the way you put it, because you said you nursed two overpriced Coca-Colas. You know, just
yes,
so you could sit there and listen, you know, to B.B. And so one of the things that I want you to tell me is that, you know, as an artist, you know, during that time period, you obviously locked in on that style, that sound, and you decided, okay, I need to go see B.B., you know? I need to go see what he does. Is that how...
Well, and I still, you know, when I went to see the show, I mean, of course, he blew me away. I mean, I knew he was gonna, just because I'd been listening and studying his records for months. I used to have one of those turntables you could put like 8 albums on, and it would just keep dropping them down, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And I would listen and play along endlessly, and then I would turn them all over and do it again, you know. As I was trying to figure out, what is he doing? Why does it sound so good to me when he does it, and it doesn't sound that good when I do it? And I couldn't figure it out. So I thought, well, maybe if I go see him live, maybe I'll pick up something, you know. Maybe I'll... But it was worse when I saw him live, because he was so nonchalant about it. I kept thinking, oh, my my God, he's hardly working at all, and all this incredible stuff's coming out. How's he doing that?
What am I going to do now? Well,
yeah, geez, I mean, I was lost now. I mean, oh my God, he's making it look really easy, you know.
That's
so. After the show, he was just standing, hanging out in front of the stage, talking to people and stuff. So I waited for a moment when he was alone, and I ran up there like an idiot.
I
must have looked like a long-haired farmer hippie or something. I don't know but I ran up to him and I said, BB, man, what a beautiful show. I was blown away, and I don't know, just gushed on the poor guy, you know. And then I just started blurting out this stuff like, BB, you know, I've been listening and trying to play along with your records, but it, no matter what I do, I can't sound like you. Is it because I'm white?
And
he did the same thing. He laughed. He said, no, that's got nothing to do with it, you know. And I said, well, why is it I can't get that? It doesn't sound good. And he said, listen, have you ever been treated badly by a woman? And I said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, well, do you remember what that felt like? And I said, yes. And he said, well, you take that feeling and you put that in your fingers, and that's blues.
Oh, wow.
And that was probably the most profound thing. It was one of the most profound things anyone had ever said to me up to that point, because I didn't realize that probably what was missing was the feeling.
Wow.
I was thinking about it too much and trying to copy him, you know. And then after that, he said, listen, man, don't try to copy what I'm playing on the records. Don't try to copy anybody. Listen to them and learn the things, but make them your own, because that's what's going to keep blues alive.
Wow.
So now, by the king of blues, I was told, no, don't try to copy me, man. Make it your own.
How
you can take what
beautiful.
I do, but make it your own.
Beautiful.
And those two things affected my life, my career, all the rest of my life.
Wow.
That's every single thing I do, every single thing I've done on guitar has come from what he said to me, and that's not an exaggeration. That he so changed my thinking about guitar playing and about blues. And then I started realizing that's what's missing in blues, and that's why blues is way more complicated than you think it is.
Ah, so there's the light bulb.
The light bulb went off like crazy.
And see, this
really did, and then it was a wonderful experience. I mean, for the first few days, I couldn't play anything because I was confused a little about it. Well, how do I make it my own? You know, I didn't know. You know, I'm trying to learn how to play guitar, but then I started experimenting. I'd learn a little lick of BB's on one of his albums,
yeah.
And I would stop the record and I would just play with it. And then I'm starting to see, oh, well, this is what he means. He's phrasing it like this, but maybe if I held this note a little longer, or if I did this, so I started dabbling in that, making it my own sort of thing.
Wow.
And before I knew it, there were phrases of my own coming out.
Ah.
And it was just, I'm telling you, it was a whole life-altering thing.
That's a big thing, and I'm so glad that we touched on this, you know, because there's so many guitarists, you know, and there's so many people newcomers, and even, you know, we're talking the Joe Satrianis, the Steve Vais, and everybody that come in and they love what you do, and that's the beautiful moment is that you had an epiphany, you know, time, you know, with your playing, and so. Artistically, you know, you're phenomenal. Obviously, you're a phenomenal guitar player, and you know, of course, everybody refers to you as the one that, if you're the one that can understand what melody, what needs to come out of this, and you're the one that understands what phrasing needs to happen, and you pretty much identify and lay down the groundwork for what rock sound is. So you, minus, you know, charts, scales, you know, and everything else, you know, and of course, for me, Before the Lights Go Out album, there was a very simplistic, and I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to make it sound bad. It's not. There was a very simplistic thing in your head that you went back to basics for me, and you went back to, you know, where you got started, and that's how the BB King kind of thing came up. And I sat there and I tell you, Steve, I sat there and I listened to the album over and over and over again. It's a fantastic album, and I kept thinking, what was he thinking? You know, because that's, you know, there's that's the emotional thing. And so, you know, as an artist, you know, not only do you have to write this music, what do you do to go to that headspace? I mean, what do you do?
Well, there's a lot of ways, actually. There's a big variety. It's almost like I mean, I know this might sound a little bizarre, but it's almost like acting. It's like when you ask somebody to, okay, now deliver this line, but I want you at the end of it, I want you to do a little thing that will make the audience smile.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, if you take a phrase, if you take a guitar phrase or a melody phrase, and you want the end of it to sound whimsical, that's different than if you want the same exact phrase to sound a little sad or ironic.
I see.
You know, you can actually do that with notes and how you play them. And that's what I learned from blues. B.B. King would play a little phrase and make it sound all whimsical, like he's kidding, teasing with his girl. And then the next time, it'll come out like he's standing there saying, no, this is the way I am. You know, just that one, he can play the same three notes an infinite number of ways and emote and tell you what he's trying to say with
yes.
just notes. Now, that's not just blues. Blues is to me is where it comes across the easiest way for people to understand.
I see. Okay.
You know, it's like if I played a phrase and I wanted it to sound sexy, that's different than if I played the exact same phrase and I wanted it to sound sad. That's basically the premise.
I got you.
Now,
okay.
How you do that? You have to feel that. So you can't just think about it. You know, you think, well, okay, I'm going to think about it. You know,
I'm going to be sad.
Like a Marlon Brando,
right,
for instance.
Right.
Not that I'm comparing myself to him, but a Marlon Brando, for instance, one of the reasons why we think he's such a brilliant actor is the fact that he never looked like he was acting.
No,
that,
he didn't.
Everything he did was completely natural, and you understood every single little nuance of what he was doing.
Right.
Well, that's what I try to do when I play guitar. I try to make every nuance mean something.
Wow.
And it has and you have to feel it. And one of the things that he was really Brando and any good actor is good at is that they actually feel the emotion instead of acting like the emotion.
I see.
They actually feel it. And that's what I do. I mean, as a younger guy, one of the ways I would try to play that way on stage was like Alice.
Right.
I know this is going to sound silly, but I would pretend there was a girl out in the audience.
Perfect. Perfect.
And I'm going to try to seduce her all night
yes.
with my playing.
Yes, that's what I want to hear. That's what I'm
talking. That's what I did.
That's what I'm talking.
No,
okay. Just out of curiosity.
I tell you what, it works. I'm trying to communicate to this girl that I don't know. And I don't even have to see a girl. It's just I envision there's a girl out there.
Right.
Who I'm going to try to seduce her all night with playing guitar. So now, when you think that way, the phrases you play are communication phrases. They're not phrases where you're trying to beat her over the head, you know?
No.
So you're trying to get to her soul. You're not trying to beat her on the head.
You're not a caveman. You're not trying to drag her by her hair.
No.
You're trying to coax her out of the corner.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you're gentle sometimes, you're aggressive sometimes. There's a whole gamut of feelings. And I tell you, at the end of the night when I was finished with the show, you know, you're on cloud nine. I mean, there's a lot of adrenaline and because it's there's this thing that happens when you're putting out that kind of emotion all night long. I mean, I suppose it's like a runner's high, you know?
Of course, of course.
And that's what works for me. So when I'm playing, even in the studio or wherever I'm playing, I try to create phrases that say something.
Perfect.
Not just, you know, pretty notes or
no,
whatever. You're not trying to do that. You're trying to actually say something. Because I don't have lyrics, I have to try to do it with words and melody.
There it is.
Without words, but with melody. And the thing is, I started learning how to do that when I was 8 years old, when I started on lap steel, because lap steel is all, it's a very melodic instrument.
It is. And you and I did talk about that, because you were talking about the lap steel guitar, and it was, and oddly enough, as much as I knew about you and all the different things you've done, that was one thing I forgot, you know, and the lap steel, I mean, that's a very specific thing, you know,
yeah.
And it's a very, you know, and it's the way it translates, it's so much different. I mean, so you literally have to, you know, be kind of in tune, in touch, and there's this whole feel thing that comes with that anyway.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because I had a great teacher back in my hometown of Decatur, Illinois. He was a great, great teacher. And he was very, very good with children. He was very good at teaching kids. His wife, too. His wife taught accordion, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But anyway, so he, because of the type of instrument, because of how that instrument is, everything you do is melodic.
Yes.
So from the time I was 8 years old, I mean, that's all I heard and all I played was melody. So when I got into regular guitar and I started quote-unquote jamming or trying to learn how to jam and stuff, I did the usual thing what guitar players do. You sort of have a handful of licks and you just go at it.
Of course.
But after a while, I started finding that if I brought back some of this melodic thinking, that the solo was more fun and it was more interesting to listen to.
Yes.
And again, that I have to say that the man who reminded me of all that was B.B. King.
Perfect.
Once he said that to me, it just opened up the floodgates and all kinds of things, the things from Lap Steel that I'd learned and all that stuff came back to me.
Isn't it funny that sometimes everybody thinks that it's like this real magical, you know, spell, or this real magical piece, like, you know, that nobody knows and you have to pay for it or whatever. And sometimes, and when you finally hear that one piece that makes all sense, sometimes it's so simple and you're like, That's it.
Yeah, and BB, well, BB was such a gentle, sweet man, and he was so generous with his time. I mean, he stood there and talked to me for half an hour, and he was just the sweetest guy. And I to have him take that much time with me, it just meant all the world to me, and it still means an immense amount to me when I think about it. Every time I think back at it, I think it's one of the most beautiful times of my life.
Wow.
I wish I could have hung out with him for a couple of weeks, you know.
You know what? I'm glad he hung out with you, too. I tell you what I'm going to do. What I need to do, and I don't need for you to go anywhere. I'm going to place you on hold, okay? So just kind of hang tight. I'm going to play a commercial break. But coming up out of the commercial break, since we're talking some of the blues and stuff, off your album Before the Lights Go Out, I want to play for everybody the other side of the coin. Because that was one that I kept going back and forth on, going, man, there's a story here.
Okay, great.
So hang tight with me for a minute, Steve, okay?
I will, yes.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, for those of you that are tuned in, you're hanging out with me, D's Radio Memphis Around the World. We have a fantastic special interview with none other than the Deacon of Rock and Roll himself, Mr. Steve Hunter. I got some more of his music coming up after this commercial break, and I got more of him right here. So don't go anywhere, because you're hanging out with me, D, right here on Radio Memphis. That's some more Mr. Steve Hunter for you right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuning into Radio Memphis Around the World with me, D, the other side of the coin off his latest album, Before the Lights Go Out. One of the things you may not know about Steve Hunter is that he was voted into the Michigan Rock and Roll Legends Online Hall of Fame as one of the first instrumentalists to do so, right? And if you actually go and check out some of the things that he's got going on, including all his music, stevehunter.com, you'll find out that Steve Lukather says that Steve Hunter is one of a kind and a trailblazer of the hybrid of blues and what is now classic rock. His unique touch and soulful style and original fat tone has been and is an inspiration to all us guitar heads, along with none other than Mr. Leslie West. He says, I always knew Steve to be a really good guitarist till I did the Night of Guitars, and I realized he was no longer a good guitarist, but he's a great effing guitarist. And that great guitarist is on with us right here live on Radio Memphis. How you doing, honey?
I'm doing great. I'm just kind of a little taken aback when I heard that Adam and Eve has a commercial on
you,
their show.
You know, I'm sorry. Yeah,
I think that's awesome.
Well, remember, this is the enticing thing. We're not going to bat them over the head. Remember, we're going to entice them.
I got you. Well, it was wonderful to hear.
Perfect. I wanted to see. Now I'm blushing. Steve, you just thrown me off my game.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay, because that means you're doing your job and you're actually very good at what you do. Now look, that song right there, The Other Side of the Coin, I heard in my heart, I heard Beale Street. I heard the sound, I heard the tone.
I'll tell you where that song came from.
Okay.
Back in the days when I was once I discovered blues and I started buying every record I get my hands on to try to learn more and more about the different styles and different techniques and different types of blues and everything. And I just got well into it. I got very absorbed in it.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites that popped, well, of course, Willie Dixon was one of my favorites because there are a lot of songs that were done. Well, Zeppelin, we know, did a lot of their songs, but Cream did a lot of Robert Johnson. So I went back and rediscovered a lot of these people.
Yep, yep.
And I had heard Johnny Winter do Little Red Rooster, and I wondered where he got that. And he said Jimmy Reed. You know, he gave him credit on stage for being the writer.
Wow.
So I went back and found this Jimmy Reed album, and I just loved it. It's one of the records I just play over and over. Jimmy Reed had this way of playing these slow, sexy shuffles that just killed me. I just couldn't understand how they could all lay into the pocket like that and just not budge. It was one of my favorite records as one of Jimmy Reed's solo records. And so that's my tribute to Jimmy Reed.
That is perfect. And it was funny because when that went, and that was the one I kept playing over and over because, you know, again, I'm sitting there going, I hear it. I hear the tone. I hear the touch. I hear it. You know, and it's he's here. It's like you're here. You're here in Memphis, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's beautiful, you know, because I'm, you know, and again, you know, music is such a beautiful thing. And you can touch somebody and you can get out, you know, you can reach out to somebody, you know, by simple notes and stuff when you really know what you're doing with those notes. And so that one right there was very cool for me. And while I'm thinking about it, I need to tell you, the other night I was on air. I do some stuff for a Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series, and we do load-ins. We talk to like engineers, we talk to producers, we talk to the tech guys, we talk to people behind the scenes. I had Robert Scoville, Dancer McCullough, and Night Bob all on the phone at the same time.
And, oh, cool.
Yeah, and I played one of your songs for them. And, you know, and when I came back live, they were like, man. And instantly was like, he is the man. It goes, if you, he's the one, you know, he's the one that plays, and he's the one that makes it right. And they wanted me to send you some love. And so I
went. Oh, well, that's really wonderful. Thank you for that.
You are so welcome and stuff. And again, of course, I also need to give a big shout out to Eric Scott, because Eric Scott is the one that introduced you and I to each other so that we could have this moment here on air with us at Radio Memphis. And so I want to give him a big thank you as well. And it's just funny to me how everybody's worlds all kind of collide, you know, together, and you know, and everybody still has that innate, you know, that innate desire, you know, to listen to what everybody else has got going on, number one. But number two, you know, I bring up your name and they are still like, he's it, man. He's the deal. You got to follow him, you know. And you know, for us here at Radio Memphis, Steve, one of the things that you may realize now that more that we've, you know, we spent some time and we've talked, you know, we not only do we have a ton of cool fans that tune in, but we have a lot of artists and musicians and stuff. And, you know, they want to be inspired and they want to know where it comes from. And, you know, you're explaining and you're sharing the exact same moments that anybody else, you know, can actually walk the same path and have that one special 10 minutes with B.B. King and this is what set me on my path moment, you know. And you've done everything the same way that everybody else has, you know.
Well, you know, the thing I have to say that one of the things I really miss about the 70s, the 60s and the 70s was there was this, because there was no internet and there was no computers and no iPhones and all that stuff, the communication had to be verbal. It had to be, you had to go talk to people or you had to read their interviews in a magazine.
Yep.
You know, you had to turn the page.
Yep.
Or you had to go up to the guy and ask them a question. And when we got on stage, even if you didn't know any of the musicians, the beautiful thing about blues is I could go on stage in Finland and play blues, and even if I didn't speak the language, if you say, let's do a 12-bar, 1-4-5, and everybody on stage is going to know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So you instantly have a communication there. You instantly have a groundwork for communication.
Yes.
And I miss those days where, you know, the people told stories.
Yep.
They didn't do videos. They didn't do videos, and they didn't do posts.
They
actually did stories. Now, I know that makes me sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but I have all that stuff. I have an iPhone, an iPad, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate the convenience of what it's done. But in the creative side of things, and when you talk about music and stuff like that, you got to have that one-on-one with somebody, I think. You know,
you
got to have that being on stage with them and jamming and learning how they play and learning how you can fit your playing into their playing, it just doesn't happen like that anymore. And I really miss that.
See?
You know?
And I'm glad you said it in that way, in that sense too, because you know the guys, you know, on the phone the other night, that was, you know, that was during that same time period, obviously, because they were also, you know, they were working on some projects, you know, or part of some of the things that you were doing. That's how you guys knew each other, Alice Cooper, you know, all those other things.
You know the
same instance of, you know, everything was always all about the music. You know,
yeah.
It was all about the music and how you could portray the music and how you could actually, you know, put it in, you know, and present it to somebody that would you know, receive it. And, you know, and it was, you know, it's a very emotional, you know, a very touching, you know, telling thing. And it's funny because, again, I'm like you. I don't want to sound like the old fuddy-duddy either. At the same time, though, you know, there is something to be said of you know, those relationships and stuff that, you know, that you've made. B.B. King was a really, really big one for you. A lot of people maybe not realize that, you know, not only, you know, growing up in school and high school and stuff, and you kind of had your bands, as you said earlier in the interview. You also spent some time, you know, as far as in the Army. You also spent some time, you know, performing as far as, you know, the SEOs and, you know, and things like that. Was music always, you always knew that you were going to do this? I mean,
well, I'll tell you, I didn't know I was always going to do music as a career, but music was in my blood from the time I was about 3 years old.
Perfect.
I don't know how it got there.
Okay.
It was just there, and I was aware of things, musical things. I don't have perfect pitch or any of that stuff, but I was aware of melody and things like that when I was 3 years old. It was just there, and I thought everybody had it. I didn't know there was anything special. Now later on, of course, I found out there are a lot of people that have that. There are a lot of people I met along the way who said, yeah, you know, same thing for me. I was about 4 years old, and I was able to sing harmony and all that stuff.
Wow.
And a lot of people have that. It's just one of the things I was born with it. So, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I thought it was really going to be a hobby, you know.
Okay.
Because when I started getting older, I was a real nerd bookworm guy in school. I really liked science and math and stuff. I thought I was going to be a doctor.
Okay.
That's what I was looking towards doing, was being a doctor. And when I was in the Army, I worked as an X-ray technician in a hospital, the U.S. Army Hospital in Okinawa. That's where I was stationed.
Wow.
And
okay.
There was a USO, it wasn't a USO show, but it was a contest. It was a talent contest amongst all the military. And some of my friends kind of persuaded me that, well, you should do it. You should try out. So I learned a blues tune. I just sort of wrote you don't really write a 12-bar blues tune. You just play it, you know.
Well, right, you just go.
I got a couple of guys. I got a bass player and a drummer. And now I'm going to say this is going to sound weird, but they were black guys.
Okay.
But the reason I'm saying that will come up later. You'll
okay.
See why I'm saying that.
Okay.
So, and I loved them. They, you know, when I looked at them and said we're going to do blues, it was like, okay, how do you want to do it? And they were already there. You know, I didn't have to discuss anything with them. And I loved the way they played it. You know.
Perfect.
So I got on the stage, and I was introduced. Here's the funny thing. I was introduced. And in the front row of the theater was all of the ambulatory patients from the hospital.
Ah.
They were bussed over to the theater, and they got the front row because they were all wounded.
Of
they were
course.
All guys from Vietnam that were wounded, and so they were ambulatory. You know, like they had crutches or some.
Yeah.
Other, a couple of them were in wheelchairs, and they took up the first couple of rows.
Okay.
And unfortunately, you know, which we could go into a whole nother discussion about this, most of the guys were black guys.
Okay.
And which irritated me no end that it seemed like there was a preponderance of black guys getting hurt, you know.
Oh.
But anyway, there they were, and the guy introduces me, and I come out, and then, of course, I'm just an obviously a white guy.
it's very obvious.
And here I am, they're introducing me as I'm going to play a blues tune. So the black guys in the first row are, like, they're really pissed off. We don't want to hear a white guy, because you don't know anything about blues, you know. And they're like cursing me and everything. And,
oh, my God.
I mean, I started, oh, my God, these guys are going to kill me, you know, so... I turned around to the two guys, my two black guy buddies, and I said, "Listen, man, let's get this thing over with. I got to get out of here. They're going to kill me." So they said, "Okay, man, let's go." You know, so we went into it, and I actually had fun. We had fun, and we played this blues tune. When we got finished, those guys in the first two rows were standing up applauding.
Perfect, perfect.
Oh my God! My jaw dropped. I was ready to run off the stage, and these guys were going nuts.
And
I thought, oh, my God, what happened?
Well, I mean, I could probably tell you what happened. I mean...
But you know, I was in shock. And I walked to the side of the stage, just like I was walking on a cloud. That was the most incredible feeling I've ever had in my life.
That's perfect.
And I walked off to the side of the stage... And at that very moment, that's when I decided that I was going to be a professional guitar player.
Really? That was the time? That moment?
That was it.
That
I had
moment.
No idea how I was going to do it. I didn't know how do you go about doing it, you know? I had not a clue.
But that was it.
I knew from that moment on that's what I wanted to do for a living.
You won over a crowd you thought was going to be impossible, and that's what gave you that push.
Yes, and I wasn't even thinking that way. I was so naive, I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to try to win these guys over, boy, you know, I'm going to show them. I was trying to survive, really. And
love it.
I just gave it my best shot, you know.
How perfect.
When they were going crazy, I could not believe it. It was the most beautiful thing.
See.
And it just changed my whole life. I mean, it was a big, that was a big moment.
That's
you know?
Fantastic, Steve. Those of you who tuned in, Radio Memphis Around the World, we're in the middle of a special interview with Mr. Steve Hunter. And I tell you, you know, one of the things, of course, you know, we always talk about music, you always talk about the blues, you know, and of course, you know, my partner Rick, you know, who pretty much created Radio Memphis and Pirate Radio Studios, he does a blues show on Sunday nights. And, you know, and we have all the old cats, you know, that come in, you know, from Beale Street, and of course, you know, newcomers and all that, they sit down, and we get the lessons too, you know, and they're so funny because they'll tell us, they're like, you know, you got to live it. You got to live this. He goes, it's a lifestyle. Well, my thing with you is that there was a moment, you know, and it was, you know, fight or flight.
Yeah, exactly. For me, it was a matter of survival. It wasn't just a matter of living it, you know. When those guys say that, you know, I understand. It was like, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to BB, because I wasn't trying to be silly about being a white guy. What I meant is, I was trying to get it out of my mouth that I thought blues was deeply embedded in the black culture.
Yes.
And that maybe as a white guy, I'm not going to understand that because I'm not embedded in the black culture like that.
I see.
But BB still, you know, thought it was funny. He said, "No, man, it's got nothing to do with that. You know, soul is soul. It doesn't come in a color." And so it was a beautiful thing because I was really paranoid that I wasn't going to be able to play blues because I just didn't have the inside to black culture. And of course, black culture is always been a very unique culture, no matter how you look at it.
Absolutely.
And all this incredible music has come out of the black culture. Jazz, which is all part of blues. Rock and roll is part of blues.
Yep.
Blues has such a huge foundation. I think Keith Richards said, if you don't have any idea of the blues, then you don't know anything about, you can't even understand pop music today, because 90% of the music out there has got blues in it.
Yep. And if you don't...
And I think that's an extraordinary statement. you know.
Of course it is. Of course it is. With all of with all of that, you know, that it's entailed. And I guess, you know, what's funny with, you know, for me, for you, you know, and of course, you know, we talk about, you know, your album that you just dropped, you know, For the Lights Go Out, you know, Manhattan, you know, stuff and everything, you know, before that, you know, you've got several solo stuff that you've put out there, you know, even in recent times.
Yeah.
And of course, all the different artists and stuff that you've been able to back and work with. With that knowledge, I mean, can you honestly say that, yes, I was able to slip behind an Alice Cooper. I was able to slip behind a Pat Benatar. I was able to slip behind, you know, whomever, because I had this knowledge and I knew that I could go everywhere with it.
Well, I'll tell you another story that proved that to me. When I had met Bob Ezrin by then, I was in a band called Mitch Ryder featuring Mitch Ryder.
Yes.
And Bob produced that album, and that's where he and I met. And I liked the way he worked. He liked the way I played. So we ended up doing lots of things together. But what happened was, on the Billion Dollar Babies album, he gave me a call one day and said that I want you to come out to New York and do some overdubs for me on this Billion Dollar Babies record.
Okay.
So I flew out there, and I come into the studio, and he says, okay, this is the song I want you to play on. It's a song called Sick Things. And I Sick Things, okay. So he plays the song for me, and then, oh my God, it's this big, thunderous, monstrous track, you know.
Yeah, it is.
And then at the end of it, there's kind of like this cool little thing that's what he wants me to play over.
Right.
And I said, but Bob, you know, Bob, what am I supposed to play over this? You know, it's a song called Sick Thing. What am I supposed to play? And he said, well, you know, here, I just want you to play here. And he played the little section at the end. And I said, okay. And he said, well, man, just go out there and play blues. Just play Cream Blues.
Oh, wow.
I went out there and played Cream Blues, and it worked like a hot damn. I mean, it was perfect. Now, that was another light bulb moment. I went through a lot of light bulbs in my career.
Apparently, man, light bulbs need to sponsor you. Just ask.
One of them, and this one, what it told me was that all I have to do, if I can find the blues in the song, I can play a solo.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So everywhere down the line, every single thing down the line, blues has always been the backbone of every single thing I've done. I don't care what it is. Salisbury Hill is blues to me.
The melody
is very bluesy.
That is fantastic. So you basically just gave out one of your tip secrets, is that if you can find the blues, that's how you, and you can do a solo, that's, you know, it's going to work.
I know exactly it's going to work. Absolutely.
Every time. Every time. Without
fail.
And
that gave me a confidence that I didn't even aim for. I didn't think, well, here, I got to do something to get my confidence. It had nothing to do with it. It's just all of a sudden I realized, well, that works. You know, that works. So I don't care who calls me to do a solo now. I'm not going to be, like, put off, or I'm not going to be scared.
No, not at all.
Or insecure about it, because if I can find blues in it, I'm cool.
I'm all right. That's the way it should be. You know,
yeah.
I wonder about you, because again, you've got your music, you've got your solo music, it's all you, you've created everything, and then you also do session, and you go behind people and things like that.
Yeah.
When you approach a project, if you approach yours, and obviously you're pouring out your heart and you're just whatever comes to you and you go on the roller coaster ride and you have fun with that. And it takes you and it takes you where it takes you. And as you said before, if it's cool, it's cool. If it doesn't work out the way you want it, that's fine. You'll go to the next deal. Now, if you're working behind another individual and it's their project, it's saying that you're finding the blues and, you know, in every moment that you're able to do the solos and things like that, you always also know that particular project is going to be taken care of. How do you approach somebody else's work is my question, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because it's a two-sided coin in a way. Like, when I go to do someone else's project, it has to mean as much to me as if I'm doing my own, because the idea is I got hired because they wanted me to play something on their project. So it's like another thing that you have to remember, that you got to go in there and do your best no matter what, because you never know who's going to hear it.
Dingo.
So you don't go in there and say, well, this isn't going to go anywhere. I'll just throw a solo on here and then I'll go home. Well, if you do that and then, you know, Paul McCartney hears that, and he's looking for guitar players, and suddenly he hears that. Well, I was going to use this guy, but this kind of sounds kind of mediocre. See, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So your responsibility is to yourself and to the artist. I mean, you're still on the line, even though it's not your project per se.
Yep.
There's been a lot of solos I've played on other people's work that had to be cut for the single. You know, the song was too long, so they cut the solo.
Well, sure.
And that doesn't bother me because it's their project. But I know that on the album, I did a solo that was the best I could do. I gave them the best I could do. I tried to play the best solo I could play.
Perfect.
And you know, it's the I love playing guitar so much that I don't want to go in there and just kind of shirk. You know,
no.
I want to go in there and try to see if I can come up. There's nothing more challenging to go into a project, let's say, that's not that good, and then try to make something good out of it. That's a good challenge, and that's good for you, and that also helps the artist, you know, if they've got a little section of the song that's a problem for them, and you can come in there and help them fix it, that's a wonderful thing.
See, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
You know, that's a wonderful feeling, and it's a wonderful thing, and because I've had people do that with me to help me, you know, to get a new perspective on something. So if I'm called up to do a solo or to do a part, if I can, my job is to try to make that part better. My job is to try to make the vocal, my solo should have something to do with the vocal.
I got you. Okay.
So it's really kind of a cool thing. I've always liked that challenge of that.
That's perfect. And I appreciate the way that you put it out there, because ultimately, you know, you and this is kind of, I guess, visually and artistically, because we're artistic people. The way I look at it is that you kind of take it and you understand that your job is to make sure that you color the rest of the page around, you know, that object, and, you know, and bring it forth. And you know, then there's something to be said for that, because a lot of people, you know, not only do you have to be focused on what you do and what you contribute, but you also have to be focused on how it's going to affect, you know, that singer, how it's going to affect that band, how it's going to affect that sound, you know, what's it going to do, what's it going to bring, you know.
Exactly. I've been asked to play a solo on something, and a lot of times I would say, well, I have to hear the whole song. I don't want to hear just the solo section. I have to hear the whole song because I have to hear what the song's about. I want to hear the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear how the vocal was sung and how it was performed.
Yep.
I got to hear the whole song because I don't want my solo to come in and sound like it doesn't belong there.
See, you've just...
So you have to identify with the whole song, even if you're just playing a solo.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to stop down. We're going to take another commercial break. Coming up out of the commercial break, though, I'm going to play another song that off of your album For Lights Go Out. That's actually one of my favorites, and it's actually a special dedication to the most important person in your life. And so I want to pay homage to your lovely wife again. So I want everybody to hang out. I'm going to place you on hold, Steve. So don't go anywhere. Okay.
I will not go anywhere.
Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you that are hanging out with me, Deed, it's Radio Memphis Around the World. We're in the middle of a very cool interview with none other than Mr. Steve Hunter. So you guys don't go anywhere, because I'm going to stop down, pay a couple bills. Coming up out of the break, though, we got another song for him off of his latest album, Before the Lights Go Out. This is Radio Memphis. That's Steve Hunter for you right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. You're hanging out with me, D. Tianis May Corazon, and that is the sixth track off his latest album, Before the Lights Go Out. And it is actually, if you look at the album and you have it in the insert, and it'll tell you, this is for the one who has my heart, Karen Hunter. So that's a big shout out to his wife. And speaking of Steve, I have him on the phone with me, hanging out live right here on Radio Memphis. Hey, honey.
Hey,
that was nice. That right there. Just so you know, when I actually had gotten your music, that was one of the first ones I played right here on Radio Memphis.
Wonderful!
Yeah.
Well, you know that weird sound in there. That weird sound.
I was going to ask what that was. Yes.
I had to go into. I've had some little problems with my heart. Nothing serious. Nothing life threatening or anything like that. But. Occasionally I have I was having atrial fibrillations and stuff, and we pretty much got those under control.
Oh, wow.
But I see a cardiologist about every 6 months, and
okay.
One of the things I hadn't done in a while is have a sonogram. So we did a sonogram of my heart, and the tech was looking at my valves, and he turned the sound up, and that was the sound of one of my valves.
Oh, my goodness. So that is actually your heart.
So I said, wow, that sounds great. Can I record that? So I recorded it, and it ended up turning into a song.
How funny. I tell you, because when I first heard it, I thought, did I do something wrong? You know, because at first I thought it was me, you know what I mean? And I was like, no, that's part of the song. It is.
In fact, it's funny because I was amazed at how good a tempo my heart has. It's pretty good.
You know what? That means that you've got it going on. That means that you're straight. You're cool. You're not going anywhere. It's all good. See, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's awesome. But see, we learned something new right here about that particular album. I had no idea, none whatsoever. So that's cool. That's very cool. Speaking of, you know, the album Before the Lights Go Out, you also have spoke, you know, very openly about your vision and things that you're doing to do that. Did you want to talk a little bit about that first?
Absolutely. About 35 years ago, it's a long time now, I was seeing an eye doctor. I was going to get a surgery called radial keratotomy. That's what it was called. In those days, it was to improve your vision so you didn't need glasses.
Sure.
Now it's called LASIK, and there's a lot of different versions of it. But in those days, it was radial keratotomy, and it was a little more complicated, but I was going to see if I could get it done.
Okay.
And when I went in to get it done, when they did the eye exam, they noticed that my pressure, the eye pressure, was high. So he said, well, I can't do this radial keratotomy with your pressure this high. You're going to have to go see another ophthalmologist. So he sent me to another one.
Okay.
And then I was diagnosed with this thing called pigmentary glaucoma.
Oh, wow.
And I've always had trouble with my eyes since I was eight. I had glasses when I was eight, and they were changing about every 3 months. And my eyes were just going berserk. They're football-shaped rather than round, you know. So
okay.
I have severe myopia and astigmatism and all kinds of stuff. So
right.
I've had trouble with my eyes since I was eight. And then as I got older, of course, then you have the normal vision problems. So add that on top of everything else.
Well, sure.
Well, like I said earlier, I've got cataract surgery scheduled for next week because now I've got cataracts. But unfortunately, the glaucoma has taken a lot of my vision. Most of the vision in my left eye is gone, and probably about 60% in my right eye. So I still see kind of enough to get myself around and work on a computer. I did the album on a computer, so I'm still able to do function and do more. I couldn't drive a car or something, but
right.
I can do work. And as long as I can still work, then I'm happy.
Well,
the cataracts have gotten bad enough now that we think that it might help what vision I do have left. I've had this trouble for many, many years. I've taken drops for it. And I had a torn detached retina in my right eye that had to be repaired. So I've just
Holy
had
smokes.
All kinds of eye problems. And I've met on the internet. That's one thing great about Facebook. I've met a lot of other people that have had the same form of glaucoma.
I got you.
And I have a very good friend who's had this same stuff. It's all the same stuff done to his eyes and everything.
Wow.
So it's just one of those things you deal with, you know.
And this ultimately, so now that we've kind of come full circle with that, is where the you know, Before the Lights Go Out name of the album came into play. And the funny thing is that you put it out there, and you know, and on the actual album cover, I mean, you know, you've got the, you know, you've got a door, and you pretty much, you know, have a you know, a cane, you know, next to
yep.
it, you know, a walking, you know, so you know, in order to be able to kind of see where you're going, if you will. But when you really kind of get into it, this was more of a departure from that idea, in that you're not done. It's like, look, I'm opening up. This is my stuff. I got more of my stuff coming here. This is what I got going on, and
yeah,
you know, and I love it, you know, because it was such an eye opener for me, you know, and thinking of that in that sense. And so one of the messages that you were kind of wanting to put out there with everybody is that, hey, you know, this, you know, music still comes, you know, keeps coming. Music is still coming.
I did some volunteer work several years back, and when I was living in Los Angeles at a blind center that helped people mostly it was people that had suddenly become blind, like with retinitis pigmentosa or something like that.
Right.
And I was completely amazed by how these people were able to function with absolutely no sight.
Wow.
And I mean, they're one of the things for you, in order for you to graduate from the center, you have to be able to design a menu for a meal for the staff that work at the place, and then you have to go to the store and buy the stuff, and then you have to cook the stuff and present it with no help.
Wow.
So these people were able to put together a menu and cook up a dinner. I was one of the lucky ones that got to have the dinner. It was wonderful.
Wow.
And they showed me that, you know, I'm not in very bad shape at all, really, you know. The only reason I used Before the Lights Go Out, I wanted it to have more than one meaning. So the phrase Before the Lights Go Out doesn't have to mean before you go blind. It can be before you turn them out, before you go to bed.
Well,
you know?
Sure. Right.
It could be any number of things. It can mean more than that. But for me, I had just been diagnosed. I'd just seen, maybe three ophthalmologists, a couple in L.A. and a couple here in Phoenix. And they were all saying that, listen, we don't have any way of knowing when or if you may lose your sight. You might lose it all at once. It might gradually go away. It's obviously never going to get better, because what happens is it's optic nerve damage. So
you
can't fix that. So all we're trying to do is keep it from getting worse. But we cannot guarantee that at some point you may lose your sight. And that's part of the problem with this particular type of glaucoma and some other forms of glaucoma, is there's no real way of knowing what direction the disease decides to take. Some people, it just never gets worse, you know, and
right.
It stays in one place and then that's it. And then other people like me, it gets worse and then it plateaus for a while. It'll stay about the same for many years and then it'll go again, you know.
Right.
And so it's just that these doctors were all preparing me for the fact that, well, you know, I mean, you're getting a little older, so you're going to have normal eye degeneration, and there are things that might happen that might cause you to lose your sight.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So you just got to be prepared for it. And when I talked to the people when I was doing this volunteer work, a lot of them were not prepared. I mean, retinitis pigmentosa can sometimes just hit all of a sudden. You can wake up the next morning and you're blind, totally blind.
And that's it.
And there's no warning a lot of times, you know, there's no warning at all. So those people, it was much, much harder for them to accept. I also went to a place called, it was a place that helped the vision impaired. It's a low vision center in Tucson.
Okay.
That's run by the vets.
Okay.
By the Veterans Hospital. And I learned a lot of stuff there. In fact, one of my best teachers was a girl who had tunnel vision. She just could see like a dime-sized hole of vision.
Oh, wow.
And she had a seeing eye dog and everything. But that woman was absolutely fascinating, the things that she could do with no vision. I mean, she just blew me away. I mean, these people showed me that, it just like anything, you just adapt to what is happening.
Yes.
And you make it work for you in whatever ways. There's all kinds of things to help vision-impaired people and everything. It's pretty cool. It's not... You know, most people rely a lot on their sight.
They do.
So when you bring it up to them that you might be losing your sight, then they sort of personalize that to themselves, and they think, oh, my God, I don't know what I'd do if I lost my sight.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because we rely on it so much, especially nowadays with iPads and iPhones and everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that uses vision. So you think that, oh, my God, it's over. You know, I can't see anything. I might just go live in a cave somewhere. Well, it's not the way it is anymore. It's you can be just as productive as you were before.
See.
You just have to adapt to it.
See? And see, the beautiful thing about it is also, too, is that you're that type of person where it doesn't affect your music.
No, it will never do that. It'll never do that.
You know? Yeah, and that's a message.
Yeah.
That's a message to me. You know, I know at least, I mean, I can speak for myself, you know, that
yeah.
you're going to be able to, you know, to put those opportunities, and you're going to be able to put those moments out there and make that go. Before the Lights Go Out, of course, you know, that's out. I tell everybody, go to stevehunter.com, because I want them to see all the crazy cool stuff you got going on anyway.
Yeah, Karen did that website. She did a great job.
I'm going to hire her, man, if that's the case. She did awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah, she did a great job. It's a fun site to go looking around. We got some funny, silly quotes in there.
It is. She did. And it's just fun. It's, I mean, because I was actually last night I was kind of sitting looking through it and stuff, and the next thing I know it was like 2 hours later, and I'm, like,
yeah.
I'm looking at some things and reading. reading some stuff and all that. Just out of curiosity, like I said, you know, this album, you know, just came out at the end of September and stuff, and everybody's been receiving it, you know, with fantastic reviews. What is your next step for yourself musically? Where do you see yourself going?
Well, it'll be interesting because I'm going to be in a whole new environment. I'll be in Spain.
Yes.
And I'm really dying for Spain to have an effect on me. I really am. I mean, I think it's going to be really good for me to completely change my world.
Yes.
And I want to see how that affects my music. There is a place in near where we're going. There's an island called Ibiza, which is off the coast of Spain.
Okay.
In the Mediterranean. It's a beautiful island.
Okay.
And there's a place there called Café del Mar. And Karen told me about this. I didn't know about it. It's more European. It's a European, actually, it's a European form of music called chill out.
Oh, wow.
Which a lot of people know what it is here now, but I didn't know what the hell she was talking about when she brought it up. And she played me one of the CDs, and because the cafe plays this music while they're serving their dinners and lunches and everything. That music is in the background. It's in the background.
Right.
So they started putting together compilation albums. And now they're huge, very successful. And some of these songs, it's hard to describe it if you don't know what chill out is, or you can think of it as down tempo, maybe.
Okay.
Or ambient.
Yes.
At some point.
Yes.
But it's more chill out. More has a little more of an edge to it. They're all got really good grooves.
Cool.
And there's just almost all of them, I'd say maybe 80% of them are instrumental. And so I might get into doing some of that, because I have done some in the past and I really, really enjoyed it.
Nice.
But instead of using a lot of synthesizer pads and things like that, I'm probably going to revert back to using a lot of guitar stuff.
Good for you.
Because nowadays there's some great sounds you can make with guitars. So
yes,
I'm going to experiment with that a little bit. But I would like to do another album.
Okay.
Along the lines of Before the Lights Go Out, only in a different, maybe in a slightly different edge to it. Might
okay.
put a different edge to it, or just see what comes out. But I want to let Spain affect me. I want to get over there. You know, the place, the village we're staying, we're going to move to, is called Calpe, and Ernest Hemingway used to live there. Lived there for a short time.
Cool.
And he's one of my heroes. He's kind of a rebellious kind of guy, and I've always loved him, you know, because he's kind of like, well, this is what I'm going to do. I think I'll go over here, you know.
Right.
He didn't care, you know. I'll go live in the Keys for a while, you know. And I love that about him. So
he gets it.
He was a cool guy. So, I'm going to absorb some of that and see what kind of music comes out. I don't think it's going to be, you know, traditional Spanish music, but I think that the people and being right on the Mediterranean coast and that whole environment is going to, I want to absorb that and see what music comes out.
That's going to be insane. Are you kidding? I will tell you that when you get
okay, fair enough.
Oh, it's insane. I will tell you, you're going to have a blast. And also too, is that when you finally do get those moments together and you get that style of music, you're still going to be able to, you know, kind of stay in contact, you know, with us here, you know, at Radio Memphis and stuff. I am able to now, I can do Skype where we can do interviews off Skype and stuff like that, so that we can, so we can get you in that way and still do live and do real time and all this other stuff. Because I want you to check back in with me after you've been there for a little while, and I want to see what happens to you. It's like,
absolutely,
it's just like you're like, you know, it's like you're my experiment. Okay, we're going to drop Steve Hunter into the Mediterranean, and we're going to leave him there in this environment. It's like watching the wildlife, you know, on PBS. Going,
yeah, we'll have to have a Steve Hunter camp.
Exactly, and see how this is all going to affect you.
That's fair enough.
It's gonna be very good. Honey, you have spent so much time with me this afternoon, and I know you and Miss Karen are still trying to get a lot of things, you know, squared away around home and things like that. I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us here on Radio Memphis.
Oh, it's my pleasure, very much so.
I just, you know, we enjoy it, we love playing your music, and of course, you know, Radio Memphis around the world, and especially Radio Memphis Prague Time on Monday nights, you know, I'm definitely spending some of this and letting everybody hear it, and keeping up with you, you know, it's some fantastic stuff. I do want to ask you one thing. You know,
yep.
there are musicians and artists and that are tuned in and they want to be inspired. They just got started, or you know, they're just now taking down this path, you know, of the music world. What are you going to advise one piece if you know somebody stopped you down and gave you one piece and it worked for you? What's your advice that you're going to give to that one person if they were to?
I'll tell you what my advice is, and I know it's going to sound very simplistic, but it's if you think about it long enough, it works. When I used to teach at Musicians Institute, I sort of started telling my students this.
Okay.
You make every note count.
Nice.
If it's not going to count, don't play it.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's very impactful. That was very impactful. That's perfect. Very perfect.
Good
deal. You enjoy your afternoon. I'm going to play in one more song off of your album for everybody. I've got Under the Bodhi Tree lined up.
Oh, yeah, good. Okay.
Yeah. So you want to, before we leave, you want to tell everybody a little, you know, give everybody a little precursor about this song?
Well, yeah, it's a long story, but I'm going to cut it down. I'm going to cut it down because it's a long story and some of it I should probably leave out anyway.
Okay.
I'll tell you, the reason I called this song Under the Bodhi Tree is I was watching PBS a story about the Buddha.
Oh, nice.
And he, this wonderful story about how he was sitting under a Bodhi tree and he was giving his lessons and, you know, he never, the only food he ever ate was food that people brought for him.
Yep.
That's all he ate. It was whatever was donated to him.
Yep.
Somebody donated some tainted food and he couldn't, He sat there and ate it because he couldn't hurt this guy's feelings by not eating the food he brought.
Yes.
But the food killed him. And when the Buddha died under the Bodhi tree immediately blossomed and dropped all of the blossoms and covered the Buddha's body.
Yep.
Now, I don't know if it really happened. I don't care. It's a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story.
This song, Under the Bodhi Tree, is about that.
That is perfect. And I personally appreciate that you told that story only because I'm half Thai. I'm half Thai and half American. My dad's from the Bronx.
Oh, cool.
My mom is Thailand. Yeah, from Thailand. And with that being said, you know, the Buddhist cultures and stuff like that. So when I saw that, I was like, I wonder if that's the story. And yes,
yeah.
You got it right. So I am more than honored and more than thrilled to play this song for everybody. You have a wonderful afternoon, okay? You give my love to Miss Karen, all right? And if you need anything, you've got my contacts, you got my number, you got my email, you got it all. And let me know if there's something I can do for you, okay, sweetheart?
I certainly will, Diana. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thanks again, Steve.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Goodbye, honey.
Oh, Mr. Steve Hunter, the Deacon of Rock and Roll. We have been so honored to have some time with him right here on Radio Memphis and Radio Memphis Around the World. Gang, you know, you want to talk about some fantastic stuff. You really do need to go to stevehunter.com. Check it out. Check out all of his solo stuff. Check out all of his music and all the things that he's created, all the different projects that he's involved with, all the different, you know, all the different activities that he kind of jumps into. And you heard it here. He's already said that he's moving, okay? He's moving out of the country, you know? They're going to Spain and stuff. So you guys, and how perfect to talk about this during the Around the World show. So for those of you that are over there, you guys are in for a fantastic treat because Mr. Steve Hunter is coming to you. In the meantime, what we need to do here on Radio Memphis Around the World is we need to bring some more of his music out to everyone that's tuned in. So as we were talking just earlier, here's a little bit of Under the Bodhi Tree, and it's off the album Before the Lights Go Out. Make sure you check that out as well.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.